It is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast back once again on the air. Come on in and learn some language gaming. You've come to the right disco for this particular activity. Dr. Dan, American rhetorician, rhetoric PhD, escape professor, stand-up comedian, comedy writer. I do three things here. I talk to professional persuaders and rhetoricians. I talk to comedians, and I talk to the right. I convert the right if I can, just for giggles. Plus the fact that they need it. We're back here, and there's so much going on with messaging right now in the world of ChatGPT and tech AI being able to not just mimic human communication, but somehow inhabit it now. So we're going to talk about that today. And if we run out of stuff on that, we'll talk about the rhetoric of Florida, we'll come back to that. My guest again is Professor Emeritus from University of South Florida. And I knew him from the University of Texas as well, Dave Payne. Texas is under ice.
Austin in the news. Trees are freezing and
wild. Crazy. I was talking to somebody today and it's like, yeah, the entire city, like it's been pruned. The entire city has been pruned and like it's everywhere. The amount of vegetation just
that was the dramatic repeated footage was that one tree top snapping off last night. But we did receive a text from one of Elizabeth's old chums in Georgetown. I guess she had trees snapping on her property too. And amazing.
When I was living in Austin,
power grid failures just to
for sure. When I was living in Austin,
where's Ted Cruz and family today, right?
We got hit by high winds and all the, scrub oaks are kind of spread out anyway, so they're vulnerable to that stuff. And it split a tree in half, like right down the middle in my front yard. And a guy came to look at it, and he came back in after he looked at it and knocked on the door. And I'm like, so what do you think? And he's like, bad tree. Like, that's pretty much it. Bad tree. Got to bring it down.
Gone, right.
So I thought we'd talk today about the tech world and ChatGPT, which has just jumped up into the media for most people. Most people have not quite gotten in there yet. I've messed around with it a lot for the last 2 weeks. ChatGPT, for those people who don't know, is AI that can mimic human communication and build instant messages upon command. So you're getting a lot of words breaking into the utopian or dystopian storylines about for education. This is dystopia, right? So this is students will not be able to cheat and you won't be able to catch them because it's actually good, decent communication. And of course, instantly, there are also programs which will tell you it is computer generated, regardless of how well it's hiding itself. So you're a longtime writing teacher. Talk about that a little bit. What do you think about computers writing their student essays?
Well, I've had this a bit of a conversation with people interested in poetry, and there seemed to be some sliver of hope that they couldn't produce the high quality stuff. heard an NPR where they were talking about the threat to the freshman essay that
like we need to save that thing
something's got to happen there. Although I think a pet topic of mine for many years is what is the role of writing and expression and pedagogically what we're doing and what we should be doing and what we can't be doing and all those things. So I think there's a huge the hallmark of academic in the humanities is writing the essay. And this is, whether it's an ASA or not, or whether the average professor could tell the difference, which I think is way up to question.
I used to teach
this stuff for many years.
I used to so always
anyway,
be like,
a
why,
huge,
why
huge
am
number
I...
of issues there in terms of the academic product. Could it really replace the professor and how much academic essays, not just the freshman essay, but the professor essay? It really bespeaks how formulaic all of that stuff really
right.
is.
Yeah.
And we've kind of gone on a utile split between form and content, thinking, you know, form is mysterious, content is repeatable, and that the AI could reproduce content, but, you know, maybe not style. Once again, how formulaic is this stuff, and how easy to simulate that form, I guess, is what people are discovering with this program.
Yeah, completely easy. Like, you can tell it, and I, for me as a comedy writer, you know, it's a funny tool because it writes things instantly and just in endless variations. So tell it to write a Shakespearean sonnet about a hot dog, and it's got the basic structure. It sounds like a sonnet.
But can it be funny? No, can it do irony? Can it do humor?
No, the higher order communication stuff, it really doesn't do. All it's doing is making choices about what is the, like you said, the formulaic expected, the most common ways of doing this type of talk. But it's the advance of it is that it's doing it to the point where it sounds like basic communication. And it's got some elevation to its word choice and things like that. So it sounds somewhat educated.
Right. And I'm sure it does some kind of cut and paste version, at least the people that have played with it that I've talked to, you know, that you're getting chunks of information there that could have come from Wikipedia or, you know, they sound like, I don't know how much it changes stylistic to avoid the standard kind of plagiarism charge, but it isn't generating information in the same way. It's just accessing it in a kind of a hyper Google kind of way, right?
Right. So it grabs content, which there's going to be so many issues here with copyright and ownership. It's grabbing unidentified content from unidentified sources.
Right.
And it's mixing that into the formulaic way of talking, you know, within human syntax and the structures. So it's not grabbing sections and plagiarizing it. It's grabbing content, stealing that, and then folding that into kind of preset structures.
And then, but there is, you know, I mean, we have spent a few thousand years parsing some of this stuff out, although I don't think everybody's walking around with that kind of, I mean, there's got to be something like voice there, right? You know, I noticed, you know, in the standard classroom speeches, teaching speech many years ago, and there's always the informative speech, which does not really exist in the world as a speech form, right? There are informational talks, of course, but I just started noticing how much my students started sounding like journalism, right? It's your standard U.S. News and World. And part of that is not just borrowing the content and retelling it in a unitary kind of way, you know, even though it wasn't literally pieced together, although sometimes it was. But just the style and tone of informational speaking, right? There is that kind of. So anyway, it's got to be borrowing these voices from some elements of human communication, and you know, I don't know. We'd have to play with it and find out. I will offer this little tidbit just as a kind of a historical and rhetorical point, I think. I guess it was during the Reagan, maybe the late Reagan era. I recall a couple of speech teachers had programmed a computer, and what they had done, you know, and once again, this is with nowhere near the kind of technology we're talking about now. So we're talking, you know, 30 years ago. But they'd taken a kind of opinion poll, you know, paper test on, do you strongly agree, do you strongly disagree, on different political issues, and then told the computer to write the speech. Well, in terms of content and kind of style, really, it sounded very much like the first draft of a Ronald Reagan speech. Mm-hmm. In other words, I'm going to say things here that more people will nod to, right, unthinkingly, as, yeah, I agree with that. And so there's a level of generality and non-controversial, and that points up to me how formulaic most of what we're consuming is anyway. That there's you know, that another example to me has always been sort of the in extreme, the speech that the airline stewardess gives about what to do in case of a crash. delivered in such a tone that nobody's really wanting to pay attention or visualize. I mean, it's the exact opposite of good rhetoric, right?
Right.
To animate people or to act. It's sort of like you really don't want to be hearing this. And so there's that kind of neutral or almost neutered way of delivering information. So anyway. Yeah,
that's an interesting example too, because people have been exposed to that form so much that they see the form, right? They usually don't see the form, but there they see the form and they know what's coming. I was on a flight recently, an international flight, and they added humor to all of that.
It's well, video, Southwest Airlines that used to all frequently, and I don't know whether that got encouraged or just permitted, but you know, some people with really funny shticks would be doing those routines.
Well, that's the thing. Once you have a form set in everybody's mind, adding any variation into the form creates humor. I mean, that's The Daily Show. That's Colbert. You know, it's all the news parody shows. You can now parody because people understand the form so much.
Right. Well, and I think that's, Colbert is a great example in his interviews. And I was talking about on Netflix this comedian, Kunk on Earth. And she's doing these interviews with academics, and I think you'll find it a real hoot because it does exactly that. What's interesting is how these academics are struggling but determined to keep up their persona as experts right. in the interview.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think that's the domination of form, right? Once you have the voice, you have the character to play, you have the content. And, you know, like you're supposed to run this dramaturgy in this way. And if somebody won't play, you know, in your drama, like that's what comedy does. Like even the guys going and doing interviewing the MAGA people or the Trump rallies, they're using the ordinary, hey, here's a microphone from your face. Here's a question. And then it just freezes people up because at some point they're like, oh, I'm being made fun of here. I can't use my normal rap because I'm going to look stupid. And you can just see them just lock up. Like,
well, I think, right. I think, you know, that's right. That and when they stick a camera on you, you're going to go to whatever the formula is, right? It's like in Bull Durham where he says, you got to work on your cliches, right?
Right.
You got to be ready to not respond.
Yeah, and the news doesn't know what to do if you don't respond that way. I got interviewed once way back when I was still in Austin. The guy lived next door to us was a cop who got arrested for making child porn. And the news knocked on my door because we were right next door late at 10 a.m. It's like, or 10 p.m. It's like, can we interview you? And I'm like, I didn't know the guy. Like, well, just say, you know, he was quiet or whatever. And I'm like, well, he was quiet, but he had a big dog. And she's like, and they kept that, you know, because they needed something, some kind of response, some kind of interview in the piece. Because again, news is so formulaic.
Sure. Sure.
So you could tell
it's kinds of where I'd say, well, I'm not really dressed. And they go, that's right. We'll just shoot you from the neck up. Right.
Yeah. No, they know how to make it work in the format. And I think that domination of form is interesting because in my marketing business, ChatGPT is basically creating a Walmart of content. You can now walk in and for free or very, very cheap, you can say, write me 50 blog posts about, hot dogs. What we sell hot dogs here and we sell the best hot dogs and it will just do it in minutes. And so now you can put all that on your website and it's going to blow Google search. All the algorithms are not going to work anymore because so much quantity is coming that's in the form. It's not going to be able to know how to parse
right.
that.
When will Google distinguish that any better than Twitter distinguishes bot communication, right?
Yeah, it's essentially going to blow all that apart. And so
so the first 10,000 hits just by sheer number are going to always be chat generated. So once again, it is a challenge to all the conceptualizations we have about the information age because of simple redundancy. There's not really information in there.
Well, there is information in there. And this, again, is one of the things that's sort of astounding people about ChatGPT is that essentially what it's doing is like if you put a search into Google, it'll bring up the top 10 pages that answer that question or work around right. that question. ChatGPT goes the next step, reads all those 10 and tells you the answer. So instead of giving you 10 options, if you say, hey, give me Dr. David Payne's CV from University of South Florida, and it'll go and get it and just present it to you right there. And right. That's a new thing where the computer is parsing one farther down the information trail, and it's making that choice for you.
Right. But isn't the scarier part when somebody asks a question that this content was addressed toward? And so it's going to assimilate, you know, it's going to find whatever the best or most complete or easily identified source for information about that issue or, right, and repeat it there without even mentioning Dr. Payne or.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing, like attribution. Like you can also, so if somebody put up 100 blog posts on Dave Payne and I grabbed them and reposted them on my website, well, the computer wrote it, so you don't own it. You know, there's no ownership of content. There's no ownership of that information anymore because there's no author.
Sure.
So all these crazy things that we've used to anchor human communication judgment, like you said, like how do you judge the essay? Well, if they put the right question in and they recognized it was a good essay and they handed it in, isn't that the knowledge base that they recognized the right?
That is the new technology of writing. So the question is, what do we want to teach people to do? And, you know, there are all kinds of wonderful issues about that. If you look at media evolution and the psychological and social and cultural evolutions that correspond to dominant media. You know, the old Marshall McLuhan thesis that the media teaches is how to attend to information. Well, one of them is the exteriority of those forms of technologies in general. We don't need to internalize in terms of identity and voice, and the ownership and authorship. And that's already taking place consistently, right? And that's been kind of one of the big gaps that I think teaching expression for the last 40 years, we've recognized more and more the importance of teaching writing, but done less and less of it. And with the new technologies, the thing that I noticed is students do not perceive themselves as collectors of knowledge. That's not an interior state of being. Well, that is the educational model. That is the idea of the old liberal arts education. You as a person will be fundamentally transformed by being a knower and having interiorized knowledge. And so that's what, in part, the essay is to do, is to put your voice and your person behind what comes out of your mouth. Well, that's a completely alien thing. And ChatGPT just takes us to, you know, a whole new level. So, other issues right now, I think that, you know, especially political issues have to do with elites, right? Breaking down elites, challenging elites. Well, if you get rid of these experts, or these experts become unidentifiable. And as we've talked before,
yeah, I think your chair is rocking, making a sound.
Yeah, sorry about that. Got the squeaky chair today, I guess. And so one of the first thing, if you look up how to identify propaganda, is hidden sources.
Right.
So, you know, the resources of this for sure, you know, proliferation of propaganda is interesting.
Yeah, this whole, again, the concept of authorship and the effectiveness of the messaging, like if this is an advance in message quality, which is what we're usually pushing as rhetoricians, that the higher quality messaging, better adapted to the target, more, you know, within the language set that you're trying to reach is a better way of doing rhetoric. And now this thing will do that. And any nefarious human can walk in there and say, do this. And it's going to send an effective message to, you could have it write propaganda. I mean, they have moral strictures already on it. Like it won't, I try to have it write a joke about Trump and it refused. It says, you know, humor can be harmful about, you know, direct to human individuals. And so it refused to do that. Like, it has moral strictures that they've clearly programmed in. Like, you can't write hate speech. It'll say hate speech is considered to be a violent, and we won't do that here. Now, where are they getting their moral baselines and their ethics? That's, you know, another thing. But they at least at this point know that it's the morality is going to be an issue when you start making messages.
Well, and what we know from human experience is that there's always been a dominant enforced morality to speech. So, for instance, just the topic of racism. For the last 30, 40 years, there's been stuff that you just cannot say in public, right? And that has not kept people from finding ways of saying it, right? People just start speaking in code.
Right.
And so you tap in the real message somehow with the dominant mode of discourse to get to the subterranean audiences that you want to receive this particular kind of message. So people find ways of doing that, right? And if you ask, you know, how did oppressed minorities communicate all along, as long as they were being policed, right? How did slaves communicate? You know, always underground messaging, right? Codes. So I think Skip Gates, was on top of that with semiotics a long time ago about the way that minorities and subcultures communicate.
Well, maybe that's some of the stuff as they talk about, yes, this is a sea change. It's a sea improvement from Nigerian scam emails, which you can look at and go, this is clearly written by something not human. And now I bet you 95% of the population would not be able to pull out that this was written by a computer. Now, as a teacher, you know, oh, this is far too clean and advanced to be written by an undergraduate. And you're like, you didn't write this. I saw your last paper. So you got something to compare it to, but it's going to sort of unleash all that sort of receiver confusion. Like it's easy to confuse the receiver now because they won't have the clean source or the fact that they can see differences in message quality as the determining factor of the message, you know, itself, like where it came from.
Well, I think, you know, once again, we're already headed in that direction with Wikipedia. Do you really think about who wrote the Wikipedia article and it's kind of the academic thing is to look down there and, oh, well, that's not really a source. Well, yeah, no, it's not. There are people who write this and they do footnote that they're supposed to anyway. So you can find the source, but, you know, by and large, that doesn't negate the information that is there. So I think we have to look at, you know, particular applications of this, but by and large, in terms of mainstream, you know, accessing and presenting information, this is just a new technology, right? Now, how to make people better critical consumers is the authenticity or the authorship really that big of an issue? Maybe.
Well, it is if you work as a person who creates messages for a living.
I suppose. And I suppose the other thing is, the subversiveness of like with Wikipedia, people putting in false information to see if.
Well, all these permutating issues come up as soon as, like you said, as soon as you get a new technology, suddenly there's a new way to build communication that has never existed before. Like, this thing can build things in seconds that would take, you know, a regular person weeks, or it would take a lot of research. It would take skills beyond what they have at this point, especially within the writing realm. You know, the verbally, like, there's no verbal version of this yet, I don't think, but it's not far behind where it will just talk to you when you ask it a question.
Sure. Well, there are technologies out there, for instance, therapy programs. They tend to be developed around particular kinds of applications, but you can have virtual therapists, and that technology has been developed, and I've talked to the guy doing that. So that, you know, because it's a specific kind of interview, question and answer format, there's a identifiable tree of communication.
Right.
So, you know, how interactive this gets, I think is going to be another interesting dimension.
Hey, turn down the volume on your speaker a little bit because I'm hearing it talk back to me.
Turn it down?
Yeah, because it's actually broadcasting my voice a little bit when I talk.
Making it difficult.
All the tiny dials to move around.
Well, I never use the laptop except for this, I think is probably the reason. Gets back to this, you know, I guess the positive take on this, the good thinking about all these kinds of, information and rhetorical technologies is that they're progressively more democratic. And as lamentable as so many of the contemporary political developments might be from the applications of some of this, the fact that, more people through computers have access to, right, information and collectivizing and finding other people with common, forming identity groups, et cetera, et cetera. So that is somewhat democratizing. And more people are involved, and the consequences of that, I think, are what we're dealing with in many kinds of ways. And once again, the whole, the 20th century was about informational elites and them getting greater control. So there is this kind of return to things that were going on in the 1800s before that happened. And if we look at some of these, the great political divides and all the terms of urban versus rural, whatever, red versus blue, all of these kinds of things, a lot of it is more and more identifiable just education level. So it eliminates that particular, at an interesting time for an academic, the kind of widespread suspicion that maybe it isn't worth its dollar and maybe it isn't worth, what's going into it. So if anybody working in any office can communicate, can access that information and present it in ways that now sort of being trained culturally and in terms of communication skills for the managerial class, which is what a big chunk of college is doing, if you get outside of specialties like engineering or architecture or medicine, right? Then that's, that's a huge change in terms of the relevance of the college education. So,
yeah, I start thinking of all the different situational applications that this is going to come roaring into. And when I was in Uruguay a month ago, trying to tell the taxi driver where to go, I could have said to ChatGPT, right, go down to the port. I need to find this boat, to get on for this cruise. And it would have wrote that in his language and, put it, I could have just handed it to him.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about the translating possibilities. You can do more than, find the bathroom by looking it up in a book.
And there's, those technologies, everybody's been working on those technologies, these sort of advanced communication technologies come on board. And I think you're right, like the idea of elite owners of information. Can you process information quickly? Can you turn into good communication? Those seem like are one of our distinguishing characteristics for how do you rate human beings and do they deserve this job? It's going to open up a lot of those issues.
That's what will the new criteria be? Certainly it isn't, because certainly my business has maintained a certain relevance by teaching communication skills, which have been at a premium, allegedly, for right. The last 30 years. Because it is the one thing that information sources have not been able to provide.
So. Well, and that's what I said, like with the marketing agency, I've gotten paid lots of money for a long time because I can write sort of unique communication and within stand-up, and it's always been a shell game in entertainment and Hollywood entertainment. I've written bits for a guy. It's kind of funny. I wrote a bit for this guy and it became semi-famous. People identify him with that bit. And I remember somebody telling me once they were talking about him. They're like, oh, my favorite bit of his is this. And I'm like, yeah, I wrote that. And they looked at me like, what are you talking about? That's impossible. This guy has like been around for 30 years. This is what he does. I'm like, yeah. And that's a bit that there's about 15, 20 bits of his that I wrote, because it works so well when you match up that super strong performer with a super strong writer. And he's a funny guy, but he's not a super strong writer. He's not going to find very unique takes, which is what you pay the writers for, is that they see angles into things that other people never see.
Sure.
And so when you do have all the parts, but it just is presented as a singular piece of communication, that kind of freaks people out about Hollywood. It's like, oh, this was built by 10 people? I'm like, yeah, almost.
Well, right. Was. I mean, once again, we have this sort of mythology that this is all embedded in individual psyches rather than larger communication systems. And that's not completely untrue. I mean, in this case, the system's still going to need brilliant poets, or it's not going to have anybody to imitate, right?
Right.
So you can't say, here, write me a Robert Frost poem unless there's a Robert Frost. So it may well throw into relief the character of innovation in ways that we haven't really been able to appreciate. So it could well be, you know, it's sort of like the little serial numbers in Blade Runner, that the Dan French joke will carry with it a certain kind of identifier here. Because this will also, if applied correctly, it might be able to identify, you know, that particular strain. But it seems to me what happens is it doesn't keep you from being that kind of innovator. It just makes it hit the market so fast and distributed so widely that you can't keep ownership of it.
Yeah, it can be copied almost instantly. And that's the other thing.
You're just instantly into the stream, right?
Yeah. And the the co-optation of everything, like in writers' rooms, you always bring in new people every once in a while because they have new writing techniques, they have a new perspective. But then all the other writers watch what they do, absorb it, start using it, and then they're not unique anymore.
So yeah. That's an economic and commercial issue. Akin to the plagiarism problem, where the oral culture, you know, by the kind of plagiarizing standards and laws of intellectual property in the publishing industry, is all plagiarized, right? And these formulas and ways of expression and ways of talking about things. So for instance, I can't tell you how many speakers I hear that have little lilts of phrase that come from Martin Luther King, right? But this was also, I guess, Martin Luther King was challenged for plagiarism on the basis, and the answer to this was, this is from an old oral culture. We borrow those kinds of modes of expression because they're memorable and transportable and effective over and over again. Well, the kind of English teacher, here, you can't use any four words in a row that look like somebody else. That all comes from publishing law. That's got nothing to do, right? And right. why we should have ever been applying that standard to our freshmen anyway, rather than teaching them to imitate Martin Luther King,
right? Right.
So we've kind of been wrongheaded about this whole issue all along. But it seems to me that once again, there's something. While the economic and commercial property rights issue comes to the fore, in terms of what that happens, if that Dan French immediately becomes part of the collective, sort of fulfills a long-term mysticism kind of dream about communication, that we're all in this kind of collective, right?
I lift up the whole boat with my joke. That's what you're saying. All the boats get lifted up because of my joke.
Well, I mean, everybody, if what you are introducing is of quality and has value, then yeah.
When you see this a lot, again, in stand-up, there's a lot of discussion about stealing styles. And there's rampant mimicry, especially in young comics. And even you're seeing it, like I watched a little speech today from AOC in Congress, and she now sounds like Obama. She's delivering like,
in the hesitation step.
Yeah. Which I saw Pete Buttigieg do during the presidential election. He clearly got training in, and so in comedy, it's, you know, looked down upon, like suddenly like, oh, he just sounds like such and such. But such and such probably stole that from somewhere else. It's not like they grew up with that style embedded in them. They have an uncle that talks like that. So they're stealing from real life as opposed from the professional realm. And I've seen this over and over again, you know, where it's this borrow.
Well, I kind of had that epiphany with, you remember Emo Phillips? Wasn't that his name?
Yeah.
The hippy dippy kind of style. And when, if you took the jokes out of that style, they really are kind of 1950s Catskill.
Yeah, it's very one-liners.
Sort of jokes, right? Just told in a completely different, you know, register. And I wonder how much, right, you know better than me, but...
I've worked with Emo Phillips. He threatened me after one of the shows. Like, well, he didn't really sort of threaten me. He threatened to get me fired. He's like, because I was up in front of him and that shtick only goes so far that he does. And I was, you know, I'm a headlining comic, but I was supposed to be there working with somebody I was writing for who had to bail. And I went ahead and did the gig anyway. So I'm going up and doing like 30 minutes of pretty high quality comedy. And he had a hard time following it because he's his own thing. You know, like, I'm not saying he's a bad comic, but he's his own thing. And if you put something else up in front of him that people have an option, they get kind of, they're like, eh. So he's like, hey, tomorrow night do 15. <I'm> like, okay. All right. But he was kind of an asshole. Was my point.
How rare is that?
But a style. He had an artificial style with an old content. So I was always looking at it going, I know a lot of really great one-liner comics who are odd characters, and I get the formula, but right. you should be able to tell, again, back to ChatGPT, hey, write this about hot dogs in an Emo Phillips style. And I wonder what it would do. Like, I wonder if it can dial down that far. Like Shakespeare, sure, but is it going to know who Emo Phillips is?
Right. Well, you know, I'm just thinking through some of this for the very first time because this is so new and so topical. But it's certainly this aspect of it elevates the idea of performance, and that has been kind of a. Performance has been kind of another mystical buzzword for humanities and academics. And, you know, once again, in kind of the mix that this is not something in a dead literary text. History is not just right in the library. It is not all reduced to black and white squiggles on a page and then to be, you know, retrieved and accessed. But that is how it is activated, how these things are you know, activated in the mix of human relations, you know, the interaction itself. And so that has led, you know, people in all kinds, as you're aware, right, gender and all kinds of, to focus on the performative qualities of stuff. So I think this is maybe another move that is going to cause us to refine our understanding of that element.
Well, in the pipe organ of the elements that you can play with in a communication build, you know, the content may suddenly go like information and basic communication suddenly drop because, oh, the app can do that. But let's bring somebody in to perform this, you know, so that it really, you know, sings when you deliver it to people. That becomes something that, like, in some ways you're talking about this where you're like, we're just mixing and matching differently. The elements don't change. Just because an app now will do one of them. Like even in the marketing company I do that, I built this pipeline model because it's information, strategy, construction, and distribution. And basically when you're doing marketing builds, you have to pay for all four of those in order to create messages at the end that get to people. But they just took out construction. They took all the cost, all the labor cost out of, which is one of the dominant areas of cost in marketing. Now you don't have to pay writers.
Hmm. Huh.
If you want basic media, you know, moderately efficient communication, if you want specialized stuff that, you know, sort of more high end, then you probably need to bring in
writers.
Yeah,
once again, I think there will be an equal and opposite reaction to a lot of hype surrounding individual sources as innovative. I mean, you already get that in advertising. Most of it is just absolutely rote mindlessness, right? But in the culture of advertising, there are these, you know, secret geniuses that have, you know, special ways of, you know. And so I think that you're going to get some version of that. So once again, it's back to the Dan French brand here that, but the emphasis will be on innovation. One assumes.
I guess, you know, that's the thing, like predicting this is crazy because that's never happened before where you take out the basic process of communication, like even the essays, you know, the freshman essays you're talking about, we're just trying to get them up to a basic level where it's good, decent communication. It's not advanced. You're not putting heavy pressure on the word choice and the elevated linguistic structures and things like that. Just getting humans up to where they can all do that kind of writing has been a goal of education forever, right?
I don't know about forever, but certainly for a while. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I guess it has. I do think about the, when we're talking about the democratic issues here, that was the great sophist in Greece, that the elitist authoritarian Plato disliked so much that was their claim. We can teach anybody to represent themselves, and this makes them better people and more successful in the affairs of the state. So.
Yeah,
that's what writing teachers, speaking teachers have been doing all along.
Yeah, it comes right back to elite versus the average man, right?
And certainly, you know, along with all other media technology revolutions, writing does the same thing, right? All of a sudden, Martin Luther can sort of say, gee, we don't really need priests to read the Bible anymore. We can all have our own copy. Let's start Protestantism. All of a sudden, science gets started as a way that we can publish the stuff and disseminate it, right? So the entire idea of this sort of collective knowledge system of science is made possible by publication. So it's not just, you know, people monks in rooms copying stuff over and over again. So yeah, I guess it's, you know, the broad view might suggest that this is just simply another expansion of all God's children can produce competent informational representations.
Yeah, so, everybody can now write a sonnet.
So you get the job. Why, I guess, is the new challenge. What, yeah. Maybe back to the Willie Loman complaint. It used to be when a good personality was enough. Well, that's all that's left, right?
Yeah. So it goes to, you know, do I enjoy you or not? Because everybody's competent now. I'm curious what you thought. Well, you think about this, like if you drag it over into the Ong stuff, you know.
I have been all along, but yeah, go ahead.
Well, just the idea of, you know, everybody can hold on to the central story of the printing press and, you know, the Bible and, suddenly changing everything and that breaking things away from the oral culture into the print culture. And this is still a transition that we don't see because we're in it, because the moving over to the digital, everybody just acts like it's not that big of a switch. It's just repurposing all these other things, but it's going to, like, especially I think the ChatGPT has given people a sudden, like, what? Like, you could have a conversation with this thing. And it's a real conversation. And so that's again, like moving things truly over into the digital, moving democracy over into the digital, moving education over into the digital, when it can do these type of things, we have no idea really what that's going to do.
Well, I know I've had students struggle with the desire to say there's something about the digital technology as opposed to analytic that represents one of these sea changes. And I have not been able to really understand or formulate that myself, that because it isn't in the fact that it's done in ones and zeros that is telling. So there are these, I think you have to look for these other broader kinds of changes. And I think the Ong, who really was along with McLuhan, right, and for people who are not familiar, with the evolutions of these communication media. The idea is that the old media don't really go away. So for instance, ChatGPT is not really possible without writing. Mm-hmm. What can it access? It can't access, unlike the camera on the Star Trek, deck of the Star Trek Enterprise, which will give you historically anything that ever happened from any angle, right?
Right.
ChatGPT cannot access stuff that isn't somehow in print. And that not on paper, but in right, it's in written words. It can't access all of the oral performances that go on. So what has been written still is a filter on history and information. And as students have been able to write the mystical freshman essay, they have been learning to type communicate their romantic relationships, their conversations, everything in print form, right? Writing technology did not go away. It got specialized and moved into all kinds of niches as the electronic media took over. So it folds that whole set of practices and skills and technologies and how they have been once again, forming us as a society and as psyches, right, in their strengths and limitations, it's folding those all into a new, right, structure. Once again, which is immediate, faster and faster, perform, broader, less, I guess, reducible to individual characters and historical events, you know, a particular. So, there are no more mountains separating people. There are no more, right, that kind of thing in terms of restricting this kind of communication. So once again, as all electronic media have, conquering time and space in new kinds of ways. So it seems to me that perspective is the only one that sort of preserves. What are people really doing? How did this knowledge get formed? And what, you know, what are its strengths and limitations? It's still going to give you a skewed representation of reality, because it's going to select only those things that have been filtered through writers.
Right. So it's all pre-filtered. It's
poets.
It's making a filtered choice itself over here, but it's already been multiply filtered for, you know, eons.
Right. And it's going to reproduce that and perpetuate that, right? So that's all going to become baseline, commonplace. And newer specializations are going to crop up. At least that's the history of this thing.
I wrote a joke
those
yesterday.
Will be transformative.
I wrote a joke yesterday that I'm going to tell ChatGPT to write a screenplay for a movie about computers being totally loving towards humans and making life great, you know, so that it can somehow counter program the only narratives we have, which are 95% dystopian distrust of massive advances in technology into robots, because that's all anybody's got. Like, you can see it in the media. It's just rocketing through the media right now, like pulling up all the tropes of, is this going to replace, is this going to, you know,
well, and that's in the tech culture, right? Which has got its own little pockets of transhumanism and, you know, computer geekdom, and it seemed already with, like I saw an article the other day, the singularity now people think will happen in 7 years, right? Well, it seems like a big step toward, right, whatever that really winds up being. Being able to distinguish between the simulated and the AI. So,
well, and is again when you look at, we always valorize the natural and what human beings have done, even though it's a technology, like writing is a technology. We just don't see it that way anymore. You know, speaking is a technology. And so this next step of, if we do have a viable electronics, like, you know, the idea of, I want to have a decent conversation. So, and Dave Payne's not available right now to talk about the next evolution of media. And I go, well, I'll pull up ChatGPT and be like, have a conversation with me the way Dave Payne would, you know.
Well, good luck with that.
Yeah. If it can dig down into and actually access individuated and sort of specialized contents and voices and things like that, then it's a pretty interesting product.
Well, I hate to turn away back to politics, but it seems to me this could be really useful. That because my big complaint, what causes me to pull my hair out, is it seems to me that Democrats have been sort of lazy at messaging, and you know what in general, liberals kind of want to just take it for granted. I've made this case in our podcast several times. We don't want to have to fight that battle that against misinformation on like a minute to minute basis. We just want being right to be enough. And so, yeah. What if you could choose this, you know, turn this to a critical tool? Summarize all the arguments out there against the idea, right?
Yeah, or counter program this technique. Like so, yesterday,
you know, fighting misinformation could be, you know, one of the best applications, right?
Well, and you would think, like yesterday, the GOP, I saw Gates with the flag. You know, they want to do the Pledge of Allegiance in front of every congressional hearing, and so they were using the. Can you believe Democrats are against the pledges of saying the Pledge of Allegiance? Like, wow, that is so obvious use of, you know, propaganda. How can anybody see that and not see the form, right? How can they not see that this is just a naked attempt to make the left look
and
bad?
And push ChatGPT to find out, right? There needs to be a little subscript that we didn't say the Pledge of Allegiance before about 1915 or something like that, right? That this was invented as a propagandistic move originally. Anyway.
One, I think of like my grandmother who couldn't process information or messaging very well. She had a sixth grade education, not a particularly quality processor. And would this help her like as a tool? It's like, hey, anytime you listen to something, ask, you know, ChatGPT whether it's trustworthy or not.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, we're sort of identifying and stumbling upon, in my case, the big fear is that we won't be able to distinguish true stuff from fake stuff, right? That it's more in the direction of our recent media, which has been to proliferate misinformation. And you said, okay, there's sort of moral bounds here. It can identify hate speech. Maybe there are, you know, maybe we'll be fighting these kind of Twitter questions. How do you build the controls into this that, you know, that factually incorrect stuff is somehow dwarfed and made a footnote to. We're flirting here with Florida Man, I think, again, with Gates and with some of the recent attempts, the governor. DeSantis wanting to take control of higher education, and the story's gone national about parsing out what can be taught and can't be taught in this AP African history class, right? And they took away everything that is sort of contemporary liberal topics like Black Lives Matter and critical race theory and all of those, and replaced it with suggested essays on conservative Black conservatives. And
right.
Of course, two of the Black commentators on MSNBC saying, we don't know what that is, right? Exactly. So, at any rate.
Well, do you label it like, again, I was messing around with that idea yesterday, like, well, what is the white, if you just label it white, conservative white versions of history or conservative white versions of slavery?
That's doing critical race theory, I think, is part of the problem, but go ahead. Yeah.
Well, it's pointing it out, but like if you let them write it, like what does it sound like? What do they actually want slavery or racism to sound like? Which is some of the things that are driving people crazy right now when they say things like, you know, I think at one point was slavery was caused by African nations, not white nations. They were the ones capturing and selling their own people.
And that makes it okay.
Yeah. So you're like looking at this and thinking, if you can localize it down to all these different fractured perspectives. So write this from this perspective, write it from this perspective. So maybe at least we can at least see the wheel, the pie graph of all the different ways you can think about something like a piece of history. You know, maybe that's a good thing if people are aware that.
Well, it really would be the freshman composition teacher's dream. What is your point of view? Where are you in this? Right.
Yeah. So you just locate yourself instead of having to again try to do it internally outward. You're seeing it, so it becomes recognition instead of internal recall from the ether.
I think you're on top of it. I think that's probably a refinement here, that point of view, perspective would be the saving grace of all of this. To be able to identify what that is. So how that gets coded, I think, then is kind of the great unknown, right? We don't know how to trigger Google to just give me that perspective.
Right. Well, and that's the interesting thing. Like if you were talking about doing these things, doing therapy earlier, if you said, well, I want to do therapy this week, as if you were Freud, like I want a straight up Freudian analysis for the next week in every one of my sessions. And it should be able to do that at some point because Freud is all written. So it's all in the public domain. It's all accessible. It should be able to go grab that specialized, keep all the other content pollution out of the way for a week and just give me Freud.
Well, that's funny. We used to do a clunky old media version of this. In fact, it was so clunky, it was in black and white. But in the 70s in class, we had a film where the same woman's problems were treated from the point of view of a Freudian analyst, a Jungian, and right? Anyway, so we had three different schools of therapy as embodied in Carl Rogers and I forget who else was that. And so those styles of therapy were absolutely identified. So you should be able to ultimately simulate what Fritz Perls or Carl Jung or Carl Rogers and
yeah,
and if you happen.
If you choose Freud, it gives you cocaine.
Well, at least as a possible remedy. But the question is that really a good thing to have that kind of choice? Why should one choose? I mean, how do you create the menu for those choices? Because we assume that this stuff evolves and gets better. I mean, Jung and Freud and even I would think the reality therapists and whatnot have all kind of lost their branding and have mooshed together. You know, so the most practitioners out there I've even had one say to me, yeah, I'm a Jungian, but I practice this in my clinical practice, right? So in a way, we already identify, applications and schools, and it's all mooshed together. That's why in the 70s, we taught people, here, take a sampling from all three of these.
Right. Well, I think that is an interesting idea of when I have a development model that I built again for the marketing company of essentially, if you start over here with chaos of just, there's just data, and you have to turn it into some kind of information and clean that down to the point where you feel like you've got valid information. Then you can drive that into basic communication and advanced and adapted. And then you can creative and you can make it persuasive. But if you look at it, it's a very mechanistic pipeline for each one of those. Like, how do you do that? And people don't think of their communication this way, but your brain's doing that all the time. But it's doing it with inferior information, incomplete information, inferior creative. Like I've been working on the comedy writer's book about here are all the techniques I use to write the 50 best jokes I ever wrote. Like I'll show you how I applied these because so much of it's just mechanics. I can literally take a topic and then look down the list of mechanics and go, oh, I want to do a two news stories blended into the last word, because that's a monologue writing joke technique that's used on every TV show. And if you see the mechanical list of here's how you build the communication, then it's just pouring in the information, running it through the grinder, and it just creates deliverables. And so that's one way of doing creative that most people don't think about. But if you're a professional, you do, because you don't always want to think. You just want to follow the rule, and it'll, eventually you'll recognize the one that's good. But that sense of taking all this chaos and cleaning it to the point where another person can receive it in some quality of reception is really the hidden process underneath it. And I think even ChatGPT, people are like, well, what's it doing? Well, it's not doing human thought. It's not doing human communication. It's doing mathematicals. Like, it's just saying, what is the most likely next word based on human semantics? And it's doing massive calculations. So it's not doing what we do, like abductive logic of just grabbing things and all these associate, you know, it's not doing that same type of mental processing.
It's taking slabs of stuff from somewhere, right?
It's stealing, for sure.
Yeah.
It's just very invisible theft.
You know, back to your point about the technology here, I think is interesting, the technique and what happens to technique. Because I've always thought, you know, there are the Dan Frenches around who are able to break it down. But most people kind of want to ignore that and prefer, you know, once again, this is also about writing, say creative writing, the sort of the belief that these are just special people living some special lifestyle,
right,
with some special set of psychological issues. And it all just comes forth as some great tape out of them. And even though people, you know, practitioners have tried to say all along, the novel has a structure and, it sort of seemed like it's up to each individual, you know, shaman to identify that formula for themselves, you know. My favorite thing that Stephen King ever wrote was about writing. His book on writing is absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, it's really good.
And it's the same kind of, right. People don't really want to know that when they read a Stephen King book.
Yeah.
Right.
They don't.
They want to think of him as this kind of, you know, special unit that is producing this stuff. I guess the extra dimension here is that now it is more likely than ever that somebody will follow Dan French's breakdown of the technique, because they can access it. You're now part of the the instant recall system.
Yeah,
of,
I'm going to be
collective
absorbed
consciousness here, right?
Absorbed into the algorithm.
So people, yeah, right. That's right. That's right.
Well, what drives
so
people
the technique
crazy
will be pulled forward.
And I thought of this because we were talking about, you know, you could have the possibility now of a pie graph that lays out every one of the perspectives on every issue, and you could just find the one that you kind of like right now or identify yourself. And what I do when I sell marketing to people a lot of times is like, well, it's just about how much money do you want to spend? Where do you want to stop the development process? It's like, how good does your message need to be? Like, if it gets down to here and it's good and clean and it's adapted kind of to 17 to 25 year old women in Asia, whoever you're trying to sell to, do we now want to bring in specialized talent that can bring in punch up people to give you a crazy good slogan that gives that information, targets them, and is also incredibly pleasurable to hear, you know? And then do we want to bring in a great voice? You know, I know some great voice artists who will add that dimension to it. If you look down and you see the development trail, like a little ant trail down here, I'm like, just where do you want to stop spending money? Because I can keep spending money and making it better and better, probably more effective and more effective, but that requires, you know, endless budget.
Well, I think about the great Renaissance artists, that at least the story they told us was that they ran a guild and there were many artists working there making Da Vinci's. And that Da Vinci would come in at the end, you know, and put the finishing touches on it. So it's a similar kind of thing. Once again, they had his formula. They were working under his aesthetic and his technique studiously. And I think already, you know, you've got some version of that going on in advertising or in politics. How can we put the final brushstrokes on this thing that will give it the appeal and the sense of novelty and draw attention to itself? Whereas the basic bones of this stuff is pretty much mass produced.
Well, have you seen the documentary, The Price of Everything, that talks about the art markets? You should pull that one up. You and Elizabeth would really enjoy it. They talk about Jeff Koons, I think, is the world's most highly paid artist. And he takes you basically into his studio. He doesn't paint anything. he has an idea, and then he tells these amazing art students to paint it, and he approves it and gives like some feedback as it's going, so it stays in line with his vision. And he's like, yeah, the technical ability to do this is not the art. It's the conception is the art. And people are like, yeah, you know, maybe. But he's built a massive, you know, the understructure of how they assign value to that. It becomes like when people find out, oh, he didn't actually paint this, they want to devalue it. But he actually uses that to spin around going, oh, this is a new way of doing art. So it's a more valuable process. And so they end up paying for like this perceived new way of doing this that's an advance, you know. So,
well, the, you know, the number of stories about what one can sell out there are with these NFTs and things like that, right?
Yeah,
and this is all shares of Conway West's tennis shoes and things like this. But
yeah, and this all directly underlies it. That's why I say I think you'll enjoy it a lot. There's another one called Honey and the Bunny and the Boxer, or Honey and the Boxer. It's about two artists, and the guy was this crazy little Korean artist in New York who never had anything actually work, and then started punching the big canvases with boxing gloves covered in paint. And he became famous for that because it had a nice story behind it and stuff like that. And then it turned out his wife was the actual really interesting, cool artist in the whole thing. Wow. So you get all that narrative adding, you know, to add value. People are paying for the story. They're not paying for the art. Sure. Again, all these things are going to start folding in, I think, again, on these issues as we get a more complicated understanding of, yeah, great, you just wrote me an essay, a blog post, but can you write me a love poem to my wife that will make a difference?
Well, I think conceptual art, you know, and that has been an issue. I remember, this was about 1974, the San Francisco Museum, there was a protest with people carrying signs saying down with conceptual art, and then they handed you a card saying this is conceptual art, right?
Right.
I think Lewis Lapham from Harper's had a lovely piece about, it was a conceptual art piece called 10,000 Lines Drawn on a Wall Lightly or something, and the basic art thing that you purchased was the instructions for putting these lines on the wall. And for a fee, his guild would come along and actually do that, but the actual sellable, marketable art piece itself was the set of instructions. So that kind of thing has been headed that way for a long time.
Well, and I think this is, in some ways, those issues now breaking into real life, everyday communication. And it's definitely breaking into it from a business perspective, where people have been paying writers and things like that for a long time. Like, I've got a friend who lives a couple of blocks from here, and she's a hardcore ghostwriter. I interviewed Jill Biden's ghostwriter on this podcast, and they're getting $50,000, $75,000 to sit there and help people parse their life and their perspectives into a, you know, a readable sure. text. This ChatGPT will do that. It'll write that book, you know, and if you don't like the way it sounds, you can go make this sound a little more, a little nicer or something, and it'll change the adjectives. So from a business of message production standpoint, this is a, you know, it's the automation of messaging, just like the auto industry. And suddenly, oh, we don't need 300 people here. We need 4.
Well, you know, I remember this was 1982. I remember an ad that was posted professionally for people in my discipline, the you know, newsletter, or whatever. Wanted speech writer, must be able to write paragraphs like E.B. White. Perfect.
That's exactly what this would do. Yeah.
That $85,000 job, which was a lot of coin in 1982, just went away. Turned out that the ad was for Lee Iacocca's speech writer.
Oh, really?
And I met the guy, and he later had worked for Gerald Ford. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, hopefully all that specialized kind of communication will not be programmed into ChatGPT too quickly, because...
Well, but I think that isn't that what people are doing with? Say, hey, write me some paragraphs like E.B. White, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I need to mess around a little bit more with it, because it can do Shakespearean sonnets. It can do, like I told it to write love songs to a hot dog, stuff like that, or a country song. And it does it, but it'll repeat the same pattern over and over again. And you're not going to be able to make make your bones on this as a country song. Like if you sang it, people would be like, I don't, you know.
Don't underestimate country music's ability to latch onto a formula. Come on.
I used to think like you could just take any cliche and change like one of the nouns to love and it would make a country song. So I had Don't Cry Over Spilled Milk. It's like Don't Cry Over Spilled Love. Like that probably work, you know.
Yeah, probably.
So well, that is some chat GPT from people like who've worked in messaging for a long time and now see this sort of looming beast of, you know, AI coming over into our world. So it's going to be interesting to see what it does, this slouching beast towards our Bethlehem.
Well, I think it's, you identified some real issues here that be interesting as it takes form.
Well, we'll come back around once it takes over, or maybe we'll just have ChatGPT do this podcast next time.
And I guess if we could just feed our past 15 chats into it, it could probably simulate me pretty well. So,
wow, that would
whether that's a good thing or not, I don't know.
Hey, you live on forever. I want to hear some new Dave Payne, and there you go, some new Dave Payne. Well, cool.
Harrison Ford was talking about that on Colbert last night, saying that. They can now take everything he was ever in and simulate him. And he was remarking about, you know, that they've actually then, I guess, done some photography of him taking, you know, various points on his face just to kind of locate him. And then that would just simulate him as a younger man and stuff like that.
Yeah. It's, so,
it's going on.
Well, when you pull this all over into imagery and video, that's a whole, like in some ways, this is deep fake writing, right? You've had this whole deep fake thing has been around for a while in video and imagery and stills, but now you're like, oh, it's coming over here.
Right. Into the intellectual property and arts. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, and that raises a whole nother dimension that we didn't really dive into, which is, the lack of credibility and the suspicion on the part that is fueling the right about all things elite, all things authoritative, all things objective. There is a sort of a reprise of anti-objectivity, and it, once again, it comes, you know, under the heading of six things from the 60s that come back to haunt you. they're citing these old, you know, new journalists about objectivity. No, we need to be advocates. We need to do social justice as evidence that objectivity is dead. So just when you need it.
Well, and that is the interesting thing about the right's messaging machine is they have intellectuals sitting over in think tanks, harvesting from these places and then driving it down into, hey, bitch about the not doing the Pledge of Allegiance in Congress. And it's goes right down to deliverables. It may be a very deep theory, but it's driven right down to a concrete, digestible deliverable that they can then say, that's Trump. You know, he gives you all the quick playouts, all these incredibly dense theories that you can attach it to, but he doesn't need to. He just needs to, again, like you said, work on the paranoia of modern humans.
Well, here's a parting epiphany for me, and as we just came to it, we've taken a monological model of communication that there's an author and a source, and now you can have Plato teach your basic rhetoric class or whatever, but that knowledge that communication is produced by authors and sources and situations, etc. But it's back to Plato. The real heart of this stuff is not the single message living its life out there, which is the psychosis of mass media. It is the dialectic. And so this thing has to be capable of reproducing the dialectic. If one politician can say, okay, write me the encomium on the Pledge of Allegiance and why we must give it, somebody could push a different button and say, marshal all the arguments suggesting why we don't want to do that. And so the dialectic can be reborn anew. And I guess the scary part of that is, once again, it's like a Star Trek episode where the two brains are arguing with each other rather than human beings actually trying to get, you know, make their way through life. Anyway, the parting thought here is add to all of these constructions about communication that the dialectic is the Platonic idea that dialectic is kind of what saves us. There is always another case to be made.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, there you go. That Plato's going to save us once again, I think, is the message.
So, well, maybe.
Maybe. I don't know. he's still hanging out in his cave. Like, I'm not sure he wants to get out and save everybody, even though he talks so much about it. All right. Well, this has been fun. We'll circle back around maybe in a few weeks or the next iteration of ChatGPT, and we'll go ahead.
Maybe I'll frighteningly know more about it then.
Yeah, so. Get in there and play around with it. I'd be really interested to hear your perspective because it's got a bunch of really interesting, you know, folds in it. So, all right. Well, this has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We will see you next time. Get out there, persuade, or the computers will do it for you.